Hi, I'm Michael Waldman. I'm the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. And on today's podcast, Liza Goitein of our Liberty and National Security Program will be interviewing Scott Horton. Scott is the author of a book, Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Now, in this book, Scott Horton takes a deep look at the history of national security, at the way we've fought over going to war, over secrecy, over the public's right to know, really since the beginning of our democracy. And, of course, it's not only history. He brings it up to date by discussing the absence of congressional oversight and the evolution of the CIA into what he considers to be something of a paramilitary organization. For more on this and other subjects, be sure to visit our website at brennancenter.org. And while you're there, please do sign up for one of our content-rich electronic newsletters. Now, here's Liza.
I'm Liza Goitein. I co-direct the Liberty and National Security Program here at the Brennan Center. And we're going to be hearing today from Scott Horton, the author of this new book, The Lords of Secrecy. He's going to tell us about his book. And I'm so pleased to see so many people here because this is such an important book. I've been known to say, to complain, that I just don't really have enough time to read books anymore. I read this one twice. I might read it again. So I really encourage all of you, if you have not yet read it, to read it. There are copies available also at the front desk. And it's really riveting reading, as well as being extremely important and timely. So a few words first about the issue. It's no secret that the United States government has too many secrets. In 2013, there were 80 million separate decisions to classify information. 80 million. A reporter asked me once what the right number was. I said, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that 80 million is north of that, of whatever that number is. As we now know, because of Edward Snowden, the government classified court opinions that dramatically reinterpreted the law to allow the NSA to collect the telephone records of essentially every American. And in order to shield this fact from disclosure, the Director of National Intelligence gave false testimony to Congress, later saying that it was the least untruthful answer he could give. It's kind of funny. I always think truth is sort of like pregnancy. You are, you aren't. It is or it isn't. It's sort of yes or no, but I guess not. There's also the CIA's torture program, which has recently been in the news. This program was discontinued several years ago and yet remained such a closely guarded secret that the Senate Intelligence Committee had to fight tooth and nail to get access to documents to review that program. And in fact, the CIA went as far as to accuse Senate staffers of a crime, essentially for conducting oversight. And only just a month ago, after 12 years after the program began, did the public actually have a chance to learn the facts and the details of that program. So it's clear that there's a problem. But unfortunately, this is one of those cases where recognizing the problem doesn't go that far towards solving it. Instead, it's really important to understand why the government has become so secretive. What are the tools for maintaining this secrecy? Who benefits by it? And what are the effects on the functioning of our democracy? And that is why Scott's book has performed such an important service, really grappling with these questions. A few words about Scott. He is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and the recipient of the National Magazine Award for Reporting for his writing on law and national security issues. He lectures at Columbia Law School and is a practicing lawyer. In his career as a human rights advocate, he served as counsel to Soviet dissident Andrei Sakharov, among other notable clients. So he's no stranger to institutional secrecy. So I'm going to turn this over to Scott to tell us about his book. Then I'll have a few questions that I've been dying to ask him, and then I will open it up to all of you.
Well, it's a great pleasure for me to be here with you today, and also to see so many familiar and friendly faces in the audience. I thank all of you for coming out here on this brutally cold day, and hope we're able to offer you some sustenance, both physically and spiritually, in the discussion that we're going to have today. And I promise it is going to be a discussion, so I'll make just a few remarks, and then I think we want to move to some questioning and some discussion, so that you'll have an opportunity to get some questions in. I want to say up front, too, some things about the Brennan Center. You know, I subscribe to the newsletters and the emails, and, you know, I guess I subscribe to lots of these things, and they clutter my email box, but that's not the case with the Brennan Center, because I find that there's always something really interesting in them. I mean, in fact, frequently it's the announcement of some report, and I go in and I download and click on and read the report, and I find the reports are usually really good and really important. And I think this organization in particular, it's active in many, many different fields, but, you know, the activities of the organization in the national security area and also in the voter rights area, I think, are just critical, and it's at the top of the game in both of these areas. In fact, I have to note the report that you led dealing with secrecy and classifications. When I started writing my book, I pulled out a lot of different things and I read it. I thought this was an absolute gem. I mean, it was brief, concise, covered all the major issues, and unlike almost everything else that had been put out there, actually offered practical solutions to some of the problems, which I was happy to pick up on in my book and endorse. So I'm doubly happy to be here at the Brennan Center today. I picked up this topic and started working on it because I was conscious about a very serious problem in the public discourse about secrecy. I think it had been dominated for years by government claims that secrecy is necessary to protect national security. Those who expose secrets are endangering American service personnel around the world and the safety and security of Americans at home. These claims frequently were presented in a exaggerated, sometimes even in a hyperventilating fashion. I think we saw that both with the Manning disclosures and with Snowden. The arguments assume that secrecy doesn't have any cost to a society. It's sort of a one-way street. The secrecy is needed to protect us, and disclosing secrets harms us. And on the other hand, civil libertarians would be sort of oddly disengaged with the idea of secrecy. So they would instantly suggest that the government's maintaining secrets for improper purposes, that it's doing this basically to cover up or disguise the fact that it's misleading the public, or that there's something embarrassing in the background, without really much recognition that there are circumstances where you do have to have secrets and where those boundaries follow. So it seemed to me that the public discourse in this area was really deficient. And in my book, of course, I discuss pretty much all the topical issues, you know, drone wars and whistleblowers and Snowden and the decisions to intervene in Libya and many, many other things there. But I start out trying to grapple with this question on a much more theoretical level, trying to identify tools that we can use to help us sharpen and deepen the debate about secrecy in the country, and to provide, you know, rules for decision about when secrecy isn't appropriate, as opposed to what seems to be the default setting in Washington, which is that everything, including cafeteria menus, should be secret. And I break my inquiry into two different areas where I think we can pull out a lot of very useful information. So the first is political theory, and the second is sociology. And in the area of political theory, I think we have to start by asking what it really means to be a democracy. Because that term in political discourse in the United States, it's something of a debased coinage. I mean, it just gets used all the time, and it doesn't really seem to have much content at all. And the way many people use it, democracy means that every 4 years, we have a beauty contest between two attractive television personalities about who's going to be our leader. That's democracy. By the way, for the Greeks, that is tyranny, actually. That's actually their definition of tyranny. I mean, you elect or you choose, which may be through a voting process, one individual who then make all the decisions. That was tyrannos. So that's definitely not what democracy means. And on this subject, I try to go back and look at a lot of the scholarships, a lot of recent scholarship about what has historically been meant by this term, particularly what was meant at the beginning in the 4th and 5th centuries before the Common Era and Athens when this is launched. And this is an area where for centuries we've had a somewhat distorted view of what Athenian democracy was all about because the major sources that we've had for descriptions of Athenian democracy were people who hated it, were sworn enemies, Thucydides, Aristotle, Plato, for instance, but many, many others. I mean, it survived only through negative commentary, and then pretty much all the Roman historians who also hated and viewed Greek democracy ideas as something ridiculous and negative. And it's in the course of the last 20 to 30 years recently, effectively, that classic scholarship has really begun to dig in aggressively in into mostly primary source information and pull out a much deeper understanding of what democracy meant specifically to the Greeks. And one thing that's emerged from that is democracy is all about national security. And in fact, there is a fragment of what's now known as the creation myth of democracy that have been unraveled quite recently, in which we see something, and this was something that was very, very common in Athens at the beginning of this period, a matter of common discussion. We see a description, an attempt to justify why we have democracy. And the rationalization that's presented is we have it for our own security and our own good. That's the principal purpose for democracy, because democracy allows us to mobilize all the knowledge, talents, and skills of our citizens, bring them together collectively. And the whole is much more than just adding up all the individual parts. It empowers the state to act much more vigorously in its own defense. And Athens, of course, at this time was, there were a great number of different kinds of political systems in Greece. There weren't that many democracies. Athens was the standout as a democracy. And it's quite clear that Athens did benefit enormously from this democratic process and this faith that all the citizens participating and discussing issues of security to the state could come to the best possible solution to advance the state's interests. So democracy is public deliberation and discussion of security matters and decision-making about those matters. That's the essence of it, not selecting particular political candidates. Now, I would say if we're trying to figure out what democracy means to us today, one thing is very clear. If we put forward an acid test or a stress test, I'd say if the people don't have a say about questions of war and peace, the state is not a democracy. And by the way, today, everybody, every country describes itself as a democracy. Well, maybe not the Vatican, maybe not Saudi Arabia, but almost, even North Korea describes itself as a democracy, or Uzbekistan does. It's seen in the world today as the only really feasible source of political legitimacy for states. So it's always claimed, and most states that claim that describe themselves as democracies clearly are not. Clearly, the United States has a pretty strong claim. But now let's look at this definition and test this definition against what's been going on in the United States recently. And I view this as a very, very troubling point for the United States, because historically we have had a long tradition of public debate, public deliberation, parliamentary involvement in decision-making about conflicts overseas, and that, in my view, is clearly fading away today. And why is that the case? There are many different factors, but I think if we had to cite one factor as the one that's overwhelmingly propelling the political system of the United States down this line, it is secrecy. It's secrecy because if the essential facts you have to know to make a decision about war, a commitment of military forces abroad for a sustained period, if those facts are so sensitive that the public can't know them, then the public can't be involved in the decision about whether or not to commit armed forces on this. And that has led to the introduction of a modern concept in the United States, which is covert warfare. So we've always had covert actions in the past. That's what was contemplated, actually, in the National Security Act of 1947. By the way, Harry Truman hated it. You know, he called it strange activities, you know. He declared he was not going to approve those things. He did a little bit, but not much. But it was individual tactical actions. And what we see now is a war that stretches on over a decade, that involves 400 drone strikes, for instance, 4,000 casualties, and national security lawyers in Washington are saying, oh, that's covert action. It's not a war. So there's no need to disclose it to the public. Indeed, you're forbidden to disclose it to the public. Our political leaders can't even refer to the fact that it exists. We have secret briefings of a few people in Congress about it, but we don't want congressional discussion of this war. We certainly don't want any public discussion of the war. So this is the it's the actual complete abnegation of the core principle of democracy. So if you're not troubled by it, you should be. Secondly, I look at sociology. And why is sociology important? I think, you know, for the Athenians, you had direct democracy. They formed their own government. Citizens came together for military purposes and for other purposes. Well, since the 19th century, the state has emerged into something far more permanent and far more institutionalized. So we have bureaucracies now. They're indispensable to states for the performance of services to the population, and also indispensable for national security purposes. We have to have them. They're a fact of life. They're not something that was taken into account in the 4th and 5th centuries BCE. Not at all. But they are something that were studied by the leaders of the sociological school when it was first set up, who were from the very beginning concerned about, you know, what do bureaucracies mean for democratic society in particular. Are there risks, are there problems that they present? And in particular, this is Georg Simmel and Max Weber. Max Weber, probably the most famous sociologist of all time, both looked at this very, very closely. And they came to a quick conclusion, and that is there's a particularly important dynamic between bureaucracies and secrecy. And it's particularly acute when you're dealing with the national security sector. So, and they both say, oh, well, of course you have to have secrets. You can't avoid having secrets. You need them to protect yourself. There are all sorts of military secrets that have to be protected. That's very, very important. But then Weber, looking at the situation at the end of World War I, and he was really focused on, you know, why did Germany lose this war? Now, all of us here in this room know, of course, why Germany lost the war, because the U.S. entered the war on the side of the Allies, which was the end for them. But he was very much focused on the way the war effort had been managed in Germany and had it been done efficiently. And he really focused in on secrecy and the way secrecy had been used by the what we would call the national security and intelligence community there. And he found consistently, well, they use secrecy for the right purposes, but more often than not, they're using secrecy for the wrong purposes, which is to cover up mistakes, stupidities, corruption, and even criminality. So he said, if you get too much secrecy, what happens? It has a distorting effect on the bureaucracies themselves. Because instead of the best and the brightest people rising to the tops of the bureaucracy, it's actually the people who most effectively manipulate secrets who consistently rise to the top. And they may, in fact, be the stupidest people and the most corrupt people. And, in fact, Weber was quite convinced that that had happened in Germany during the First World War. Inefficient, not particularly bright people all the way at the top because they very cleverly used secrets. So this presents a real dilemma for a democratic society. So obviously one dilemma is the democracy part. Now, Germany was a pretty authoritarian place, so he was not quite so focused on that, but he was focused on the interaction with the parliament. And at that point, in the late period of Wilhelmine Germany, it had been a very authoritarian state. We gradually saw this development of the institution of a parliament, which was asserting itself and making the state modestly, baby step by baby step, a little bit more bureaucratic. What happens in World War I? By the end of the war, that is absolutely stopped. So the power and authority of the parliament is just wiped out, essentially. And you have the general staff, you have basically the war machine running the state. And how does that happen? Secrecy did that. So he believes that you can balance secrecy by having robust and aggressive parliamentary oversight and inquiry. That's the obvious tool. But there's another really important figure I bring into the discussion, and that is Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And if anything, the thesis of my book is that Moynihan is right about everything, and that Moynihan's book, from 1996, really badly needs to be brought up to date with an inclusion and review of all things that happened since 1996, and that's what I do in my book, is I bring his writings up to date. But, he brings this into the American context. And he's in a really unique position because, of course, he was the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He was a senior figure in the White House through how many administrations? 4 or maybe 5 administrations. So he knew the system, including the National Intelligence System, from the inside, had access to all these secrets. And he's probably the most important sociologist America produced in the last century. And he said, Weber's completely correct, but he's a little bit naive in the prescriptions, because I know as a member of Congress for many years that that's not enough. It does not work. Congress simply doesn't have the tools and power, even if it really wanted to effectively check the corrosive function of secrecy through oversight. His view was, no, you have to join this with other functions. So in his view, the press, something famously, Germany did not have around World War I, but the United States has had in spades aggressive advocacy and investigative journalism. And leakers. Leakers also play, whistleblowers play an important role in getting vital information out there. So So sociology tells us that all the concerns you've got about secrets being abused by bureaucracy, this is not tin-hatted lunacy. By the way, the Public Affairs Office of the CIA is programmed to instantly charge this when anyone says that there's corruption or tries to expose some secrecy, sort of a standard ploy. No, it's inherent. It is inherent to the beast. This is what happens in democracies all the time. It requires a great struggle, a constant struggle, to keep it in check. Bringing the situation back to America today, I ask fundamentally, are we taking the steps we need to take to keep this beast in check? And the answer is obvious. And we can come to that answer just by looking at the statistics of how many secrets are created. The answer is no, we're not doing what we fundamentally need to do. So I think with that, I'll just turn it over to
fascinating. Thank you,
and then
you.
Maybe to some questions from the floor.
Yeah. So actually, the first thing I'd like you to do before I sort of ask you the questions is explain who the Lords of Secrecy are, because that's at the root of some of my questions, and it's such a sort of intriguing title. So if you can explain who are the Lords of Secrecy.
Now, I have to be completely honest and say my publicist came up
with it. but you use it a lot.
But I loved it, actually. And it's the title is designed to stress the fact that we're dealing with something that's fundamentally not democratic. I mean, these are not elected officials. And they increasingly are not people who are accountable in any sense through our legal system, hence Lords. And they derive their power largely from the ability to create secrets. They use it ingeniously to give themselves greater and greater authority. So who are they? They are the heads of the leaders of national security agencies, defense and intelligence communities both, who have and exercise the power to create secrets. And if you want just one face to focus on, maybe a little bit off the map, I'll give you Richard Bruce Cheney. Now, he was elected by the people of Wyoming at one point as a representative, but he spent most of his career in this bureaucratic world, Secretary of Defense, and as a chief of staff in the White House, and then finally as vice president. And he is someone who consistently knew how to maneuver using secrets, excelled at it, loved it. He invented his own private security classifications and his own private security stamps that he would affix to documents that were security classifications that don't exist under American law. And I think the last phase of his life, he used this. I think it's sort of a horror story. I mean, he used it in all the ways you fear it would be used. So, in particular, if we look at the run-up to the Iraq conflict, Dick Cheney was on talk shows all over the place telling us he had access to absolutely valid intelligence, which you're not entitled to know, which made completely clear that Saddam Hussein was acting in cahoots with al-Qaeda, and that Saddam Hussein was building weapons of mass destruction. I talked once with General Zinni, who was a CENTCOM commander at this time, who tells me that he was on a stage with Dick Cheney at which he made one of these statements. He said, "I almost fell out of my chair," because it was obviously completely untrue. And how am I, as a four-star general, going to stand up and contradict the vice president of the United States, particularly one named Dick Cheney? So that's the nightmare scenario, which we've seen realized, but happens routinely, as people claim, we know, you can't know, just trust us. Right. Whereas democratic process is you put your cards on the table, you scrutinize, question, and decide, you know, what's right and what's not right, and then based on that, you make a decision. If we look at the way the game has played out in the last few years, you know, certainly General Hayden, Michael Hayden, head of the NSA, head of the CIA, is a very powerful lords mm-hmm. of secret. All the directors of the CIA, and not just the directors, but also the senior echelons of the agency have been. And in fact, historically, if we go back and look at the Cold War era, secrets were made largely by the military, by the uniformed military. And one of the transformations that's occurred recently is that the CIA now plays the central role increasingly. It is the master of the field of secrecy making, and it is continuously usurping traditional military roles in war making, which I think we see with the wars fought in Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, for instance, where the CIA is up front. It has its own air force,
right?
The drones. And if we go back and we check all this against the model that was created in 1947, I think the authors of the system in 1947 would be completely shocked to see what's happened in America today. They wouldn't understand how this has happened and how lawyers who are interpreting and enforcing the National Security Act have given opinions saying that this is okay because it's plainly not. But stranger things have happened inside the Washington Beltway.
Well, one of the things that I think your book does so well is explain the connection between transparency and democracy and make that link in a way that I think is just extremely powerful and convincing. And the other term you use for the Lords of Secrecy is the national security elite. And it sort of really reinforces this notion that we've moved from a democracy to an oligarchy where the decisions are made by this elite because they're the only ones who can make the decisions. They're the only ones with the information to make the decisions, and that they are actually running things, and they're running things while Congress and sometimes even the president go about their business, unaware or unable to do anything about it. So what I want to ask you is about the torture report. You wrote about the torture report, and this is the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on the CIA's torture program. The executive summary of the report in redacted form was released quite recently. You were writing about that battle to get the report released in your book at a time when it had not yet been released, and you were pointing out that the administration held all the cards when it came to these negotiations because they ultimately get to decide what gets declassified and what doesn't get declassified, or at least that's how people view it today.
That's the way they want everyone to view
that's
it.
That's the way they
not
want
the way
everyone.
The law really deals with it.
But that's the way Congress has sort of agreed to let it be portrayed. And so what I'm wondering is, after you finished writing this, the report was released. The executive summary was released. It was heavily redacted, but there were some very incriminating facts that the administration agreed to declassify. Was this a victory for transparency? And if so, why did the Lords of Secrecy allow it to happen?
Oh, that's a very good question. I would say it depends on what your expectations are going into the game. So if you take, you know, the Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Max Weber view of what this Senate committee should have been doing all along the way, you're pretty disappointed with this. Notwithstanding that, it is, I'd say, the best congressional report of this sort that's ever been issued. I mean, it's even well written. I was sort of shocked reading it. I mean, you know, yes, it's literate, it's lively, it reads very, very well. But the standards that should be applied and that the public should be bringing to bear here are high standards. So the question is, why is this being done as a historical capstone? A decade after this program has been ended. The responsibility of Congress is to provide oversight in real time to review and raise issues, not to write footnotes to a historical treatise about a program that's been shut down since October of 2006.
Yeah.
Okay? So I think that's a big thing. And then secondly, you look at this process as a documentation or historical review. And it's very clear that the CIA plays the Beltway game very effectively. And Congress, the congressional leadership, surprisingly, doesn't. They're pikers compared to the CIA. The CIA is leaking and planting things in friendly media and developing friendly reporters all over the place, running a propaganda campaign for years, planting, laying the basis for a feature Hollywood motion picture. Yeah. Zero Dark Thirty, by the way, the Langley's view is that you should all watch Zero Dark Thirty, and that's what you should think is what happened. It's total fiction. Of course, they can defend themselves saying it's a work of fiction, but it's a malicious work of fiction. It's designed to confuse you as to the historical facts, not to mention 24 and other things. So CIA was playing at the top of its game. Congress was not really doing very well, even though the product taken within the book boards is a really good, impressive product, and I think we have to view the staff, in fact, with some awe in terms of what they've done, because I've never seen a congressional committee do as good a job as this.
Yeah.
But even though it's the best ever, but it's still only a B minus.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's fair enough. That sort of leads to my next question, which is, your book, it focuses quite a bit on the failure of congressional oversight and also in places the failure of the Obama administration when it comes to whistleblowers to exercise effective management and oversight over the national security establishment. My question is, given how massive and powerful and well-heeled the national security establishment has become since 9/11, is it even possible today for Congress, even the president, to exercise control over it, or really has this establishment become too big, not too big to fail, but too big to control?
Yes, it has. But I think that means that the level of effort within the Congress has to be stepped up quite aggressively beyond what it is. I mean, let's just start with just the numbers here. I mean, by the way, what is the black budget? We don't know what the black budget is. No, we don't. 9/11 Commission said this is one area where there obviously should be transparency. I mean, the people may not be entitled to know every covert project, but they should know how much money they're spending on it. Well, as you can imagine, the Lords of Secrecy absolutely don't want the American people to know how much they're spending on the Lords of Secrecy. So it's around $100 billion a year. Okay, it's certainly in excess of $50 billion a year just for the CIA. And, the first and most obvious question is just efficacy. Do the people get $100 billion worth of information out of this, particularly when what's going on is largely intelligence analysis? We consider the fact that after the Cold War, there was a heavy refocusing of this intelligence analysis on the Middle East, and this $100 billion enterprise didn't know that the Arab Spring was coming or what motivated it. It's pathetic. And this is, of course, on the heels of their management of the Cold War, which was eviscerated by Moynihan in his book, where he said, we were shoveling enormous sums of money at them, enormous resources, just to tell us what's the military capability of the Soviet Union. And they were absolutely wrong on every single chapter. They weren't even close, right? So you've basically got this question of efficacy, disaster. But ultimately, for Congress to deal with this effectively, they're going to have much deeper staff support to do it, with people who have security classifications and have some sort of background and professional background in the community. Now, that happens to some extent, but the depth is not there. And then I think we have another obvious problem here, and that is, when I look at the votes, and I do in the book, I look at the sort of the critical close votes on the prison program, for instance, which, you know, came within a hair's breadth of being voted down in the House of Representatives. In fact, the first nose count showed it was going to lose by a big number. And then the Democratic and Republican leadership in the White House all stepped in, and General Alexander went to Congress to lobby nonstop, twisting arms so they could just squeak through a victory. Now, you look at the vote, and you see there's one factor that'll tell you how people were going to vote, and it's how much money did they take for their campaigns from the intelligence and defense industries. And every congressman who took significant money from those industries voted with the program and voted with the NSA. I mean, that's a huge problem. And that's another issue, by the way, that the Brennan Center deals with magnificently all the time, and another demonstration of why that is so important an issue, because there's a sort of inherent corruption of the process that goes with this contractor funding.
Right. And you reminded me of something with the lobbying, which is the bill that was being considered in the Senate to reform NSA surveillance called the USA Freedom Act. The administration issued a statement of support in favor of that bill and has, in fact, been working to try to get that bill passed for a variety of reasons. On the eve of the vote, FBI agents were going up to the Hill to lobby against it. So, I mean, going back to this question of controlling the lords of secrecy, or are they a law unto themselves? Do we have until 1:30 or 2? Can someone remind me?
2.
Yay. Okay, good, because I keep thinking of other things. What about the courts? In your book, you focus quite a bit on congressional oversight or the failure thereof and what some of the reasons for that are. You mentioned the courts. You mentioned that their supine attitude, I believe, is the word you used, to executive assertions of secrecy, which is, you know, absolutely correct. But I'm curious why you focus more on Congress than on the courts, and then also whether you have a theory for why the courts have been remiss.
Well, in my original draft, there was a chapter on the courts.
Please send it to me.
And we need to get it down in terms of space. No, I think we made a call that that actually the courts just weren't that important. I mean, and in fact, as I note, you know, a lot of the sociologists, the American sociologists, thought the courts would be an important independent check on this process. And that's what particularly the people who were writing about this in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s all thought that. I don't think in the last 20 years people think that. And that's largely because of things like the development of the Glomar Doctrine, where courts have just decided secrecy's claim, there's a yellow marker down, we're just not going to go there.
Can you just briefly explain what the Glomar Doctrine is?
The Glomar Doctrine is it's a doctrine that was developed for the benefit of the CIA that allows them to invoke, I just say the end effect of it is they can invoke national security, and when they do, the court's not going to examine that matter. We'll not allow discovery about it, we'll not allow evidence to be introduced about it. It's just out. Right. And the theory behind it is you can't really be using the courts to subvert or undermine national security interests. The courts shouldn't be generally exercising independent discretion on these matters. They should be deferring to the intelligence community or the executive, shall we say, on these issues. And I think that this is one of the important things that's come out of the Senate Select Committee report on the torture program, is the courts are being fooled all the time. And I think one of the ways it comes out that's sharpest is, there's some correspondence amongst CIA staffers who are wondering, you know, we're telling the courts that all this is super secret and we can't be forced to disclose it in the FOIA action and we can't allow litigation to go forward dealing with this. But at the same time, we're leaking falsified versions of this same information to friendly journalists. What would the courts think if they learned? Well, I guess some judges are now reading the report and realizing we were fooled. And I think one's got to wonder, you know, will things like the committee report have an influence on the way courts deal with these issues going forward. And I think maybe there is sort of a rising ire amongst federal judges right now on this point. I mean, I think the few areas where we see it coming through are, you know, the Second Circuit opinion on drone warfare and targeted mm-hmm. killings, where you had a unanimous Second Circuit panel. You know, their ruling is essentially, look, you can't give off-the-record interviews to newspapers, you know, beating your hairy chest and saying how aggressive we're being going after these guys, and we've resolved to do it, and do this repeatedly, not just one little leak, but to the extent where it's clearly a public affairs program that the White House has embarked upon, and then say, no, we're not going to disclose the opinion because of secrecy.
Right.
You got to make your election. It's either really secret or it's not.
Right. And this was a Freedom of Information Act request that was filed for legal opinions, Department of Justice legal opinions, as well as some other documents about the covert drone program. And the response was, well, this is a complete state secret. We can't even say whether or not it exists or not or anything. And the courts, you know, to their credit said, or the Second Circuit to its credit said, you know, come on, you talk about it all the time.
But unnamed White House spokesman, parentheses, John O. Brennan, which I know for a fact, repeatedly gave these interviews off the record. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, and Dennis McDonough, but excuse me, another unnamed White House source. it just becomes too thin at some point. It's too much of a game. And I think the Second Circuit is saying you have to be serious and consistent about the invocation of secrecy. You can't play a political game with it. And, you know, one thing that comes out in spades in this report is they play that game all the time. I mean, there's that one memo that, in fact, is flagged and quoted where they say, no, it's all about what the American people think, in parentheses, and we want to deceive them. We don't want them to know the truth. We want them to think that these programs are in. So this is the nightmare scenario where secrecy is being used to help propagate lies, right? That's not what should be happening. In fact, there should be either they're keeping complete secrecy or they're disclosing the facts. They're not using secrecy to put out lies.
Or to, you know, could be to conceal misconduct, something like that, or just to deflect or prevent any sort of political pushback that they might get from the public. And I found it very revealing when the director of national intelligence said, you know, on reflection, maybe we should have just come clean about our program to collect all the telephone records of all Americans, because in retrospect, I think they probably would have supported it. And I thought, oh, so you did classify it because you were afraid the Americans wouldn't support it. You know, he wouldn't have said, you know, in retrospect, we should have come clean about the, you know, nuclear codes. Because then, it, you know, if it were truly something where national security depended
on it, and Michael Hayden,
you don't come clean.
Michael Hayden, who was director of the CIA and the head of the NSA, also repeatedly has made statements to precisely that effect. We needed to keep this program secret because were it known, it could be challenged. It might found to be illegal, and that could be very bad news to me, Michael Hayden.
Mm-hmm.
He at one point even made a reference to not looking good in an orange jumpsuit. Now, that is not a legitimate reason to classify something, but it's one that was repeatedly being invoked.
Right. So I'm going to monopolize you for one more minute, then I'm going to let other people ask you questions and bring up points. But I want to just look to the future for one minute. You may know about a project that was spearheaded by Suzanne Spaulding, who was formerly with the CIA Counsel's Office, currently with the Department of Homeland Security. A few years ago, she led a project that was called No More Secrets. Got a bunch of people together to think about the following issue, which is that in the digital age, in the information age, it is going to become harder and harder to the point of impossible to keep any secrets for any length of time because of hackers, because of leaks. Information is just too porous now. It's not, you know, a paper that you can keep locked up in a safe. And so the premise was it is going to become the weakest possible form of defense that is completely permeable, and therefore we have to start planning for a world where our national security derives from something other than keeping secrets. And actually, Don Rumsfeld, believe it or not, was quoted as saying something quite similar. So do you agree that this is the future, that the future is going to be a world in which you kind of can't keep secrets? And if so, what does that mean for the Lords of Secrecy?
It's a possible future, but I'm not convinced. I mean, I think the perception of that is propelling the Lords of Secrecy in a different direction, which is to eliminate privacy so that they will know. I mean, yeah, we have David Cameron. You know, yesterday was a great day for the Lords of Secrecy in England, yeah. Where some of the Lords of Secrecy actually are lords. Where Lord Evans gave his maiden speech in the House of Lords, attacking Snowden and speaking in support of Prime Minister Cameron's view that, well, we should just put an end to privacy, as they say. You know, there really shouldn't be any. The notion that there is private communications is antiquated. As the Prime Minister put it, who will say that their communications can remain secret in the face of a writ personally signed by Theresa May, the Home Secretary? I would, you know, I mean, you know, but, you know, Britain was historically viewed by sociologists, in fact, as the land of privacy. They put a maximum value on it. So we're seeing a swing in the other direction, and the swing is designed to counter exactly the threat that you see. That is, that in the cyber age, those who can hack and gain access on a sophisticated way to vast secret resources will be able to reveal them, a la Manning or Snowden. And part of the answer to that is, well, just no privacy anymore. We'll be able to look and see what everyone does on the internet. We'll be able to tap all phone conversations. There will be no space in which this sort of operation can be launched. So that's the dystopian possibility. And by the way, Donald Rumsfeld is, shock, I can't believe I'm saying this, a really positive figure in this area. I mean, even back when he was a congressman, when he was in the Defense Department, he was someone who would get documents stamped secret and send one of his famous snowflakes saying, "Who classified this document? You know, this is stupid." He would push back aggressively against it, not that it had any impact. So there you see, even the Secretary of Defense can't change it. And when he was a congressman, he ridiculed claims of secrecy regularly. So he's someone who I think had right ideas about. But I think the alternative is, and this is the Moynihan view too, you have to move to a much smaller and more manageable set of secrets, where there are really only relatively few people who have access to them. And one thing everybody here should know is how many people in America have access to classified materials or are authorized to have access to classified materials. And we're looking at around 5 million people. So you have to think at some point, like, you really think 5 million people can keep these things secret? No.
Note that the size of the federal government is about 4 million. So.
Yeah. And you have lots of contractors who have secrets, and we have contractors routinely engaging in gray mail against the U.S. government saying, oh my gosh, if you sue me for contract fraud, I will just have to, in my defense, divulge all these secrets. This has gone on over and over and over again with Blackwater, amongst other organizations. And so I think it all points to the management problems we have from having way too many secrets. So I think the obvious long-term answer is to reduce the quantum of secrets to a manageable minimum. And that's really going to focus on three particular categories. It's going to be weapons technologies. So I think the budget around weapon systems, what the weapon systems do and what testing them does, that's fair game. But actually how you build the weapon system, yeah, that better be secret, because we don't want that being proliferating. Second, cryptography. So secret communications, every government's got to be able to do that, and it's got to be able to protect that. The third is identities of covert operatives. You know, these people, it may be a matter of life or death for them, so you have to protect their names. There are exceptions for all those things, but I think those are the three core areas. Those are the areas where there is a legitimate reason for a quantum of secrets, and they should be maintained. And I think just those kinds of secrets can be protected, even over the long term.